You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, listening to music can put us in a mood or enhance the one we're already in. And whether or not you're already in a fall mood, we're going to enjoy a bumper harvest of folk songs for the next half hour. These are songs about and inspired by the season, from the work of harvesting itself to the beauty of fall to straight-up spooky murder ballads. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is on your fall soundtrack? Is there an artist, a song that really captures the season for you? Maybe while you're looking at leaves or changing into a sweater? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sheila Shigley is host of WPR's Simply Folk. You can listen to Sheila and Simply Folk every Sunday from 5 to 8 p.m. on the Ideas Network and the News and Music Network here at WPR. Sheila, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. I'm super glad to be here with you.
All right, before we get to some specific music, do you find your musical tastes or needs change with the seasons?
They do change with the seasons. I think just the natural ups and downs of emotions. I mean, I always get sort of like a sweet melancholy at autumn. So yeah, I bet if I were to go back and track my listening habits, I would find that would be shifting.
And I find often fall is a throwback season for me, where I want to listen to stuff that I maybe associate with fall X number of years ago. Do you find some of that too?
I do, yeah. And there's the obvious, now I'm immersed in folk music. So to me, fall music includes things like, you know, folk songs from the Republic of Georgia and, you know, Scottish walking songs, you know, stuff that would make the work easier. But yeah, just a whole range of emotions. In autumn in general is a pretty emotional time for me.
All right, well, let's set up the first song, Pastures of Plenty, a song, I guess, written by Woody Guthrie. Talk about the version we're about to hear.
So we're going to hear a version by Solas, and I love this one because it is just so, so energized. They do such a great job with it.
All right, here's a taste.
It's a mighty cutthroat.
Why are we kicking off with this one, Sheila?
We're kicking off with this one because I think to me, the last couple years have made me take harvest a little less for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, I think many of us listening, maybe we went through the pandemic from a place of privilege, or at least we had full bellies. But I think whoever we are, we probably wondered at some point, is the food going to keep coming? So to me, harvest is a little, as hard as it is for me to even grow an herb without it expiring. All these things that have happened in the past 2 years, including trying to grow my own food, have just made me really respect harvest more. And then thinking about the lives of harvest workers, and that song was written by Woody Guthrie for that reason.
Right, and this is, you know, Woody Guthrie. This is not a brand new song, but the themes remain.
The themes remain, and Solas has done such a good job over the years. Of course, they're an Irish band. They're made up of Irish and American players. But they've taken American folk songs and reworked them into the Irish tradition. So it's just good all around.
Okay, the next song is Hard Times by the group Gob Iron. Tell us about this one.
Gob Iron is actually Uncle Tupelo and Sunvolt's Jay Farrar, along with Anders Parker. And it is a beautiful, beautiful tapestry of sort of gritty, gritty emotion. They've taken old folk songs, reworked them, put in their own words, and then there's a musical interlude between each. It's just a beautiful project.
All right, here's a little bit of that one by Gob Iron.
Ain't got long in this world. In the meantime, I want these hard times to come again no more.
So that fall melancholy feeling I'm hearing here.
Yeah, fall melancholy, and you've probably heard that Stephen Foster song in a number of different ways. It is about hard times and just this like emotion of like wishing the hard times away. Yeah, so emotional, and the album is so beautiful because it's very closely recorded. In a world where sometimes albums can be so loud, it's just really beautiful to hear just two voices, two guitars. It's just spacious and gorgeous.
Now, both of our picks so far, older songs, newer bands, and you mentioned you also play songs from around the world. I don't know, do you find that folk music brings you a sense of connection with people, whether they're on the other side of the world or from a century, you know, or two ago?
It does, because, I mean, if you think about it, what are the first two themes have been, you know, harvest and food, maybe even a little bit of hunger, and then hard times. I mean, who hasn't touched those things in their life or come close to it? And, the role of songs, something besides love songs, and I have nothing against love songs at all. I mean, I write love songs all day.
You play occasional love songs
yes,
on your show, too.
Yes, we do. But then just the role of music in our other emotions, like survival and eating and working. And that's what folk music is partially all about.
Sheila Shigley is with us, host of WPR Simply Folk. She is giving us some musical inspiration, some samples of great folk music for the autumn season. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page if you have a favorite fall piece of music. It doesn't even have to be folk. 800-642-1234. We heard from Murray, who said we missed an opportunity to play Pastors of Plenty, the version by Odetta.
Odetta, yes, we have it. I'll take that as a request for the coming request
nice.
Show. How's that?
Yeah, definitely. How do you, I mean, there's got to be a lot of versions of that
so many versions. I wouldn't know where to begin. Like, if I were to go back to the library around the corner right now and count, I don't know how many there would be.
Okay, now back to some of your music. We're seeing, I think, some of the last leaves of autumn. Tell us about the next song, First Leaves of Autumn.
This is called The First Leaves of Autumn, and it's actually a Gallagher and Lyle song, maybe less known here in the States. They were a Scottish band, but Ger O'Donnell is this wonderful Irish guitarist and songwriter, and he just keeps appearing in people's videos. Like, he was in the States singing with the Petersons. He just keeps showing up in people's videos, and that's what I love about the modern situation, is you can just go record a song and release it tomorrow. But he happens to be really good, and he's singing here with Pat Coyne from Cong in Ireland.
As the daylight turns to starlight and the seasons turn to change, I'll get the same old answers, but the questions still remain. We shared that brief and magic sun by the first leaves of autumn. You were gone. Not until the rain has touched my face. Not until
First Leaves of Autumn by Ger O'Donnell and Pat Coyne. Have you seen people getting more creative with collaboration across even international boundaries in folk music?
Yeah, Jer just showed up. Like, I don't know. It was Pat's studio. I don't know if Pat was planning on having him on
the
song. And he just, like, walked in and sang it with him. And, of course, we wouldn't have it any other way. We've played it quite a lot here on Simply Folk across the last 2 years since it happened. But I love that spontaneous collaboration that's going on now.
Okay, now here's one that I understand is close to your heart, a traditional Irish language ballad about the beauty of autumn. My Gaelic extends to about a half an hour of Duolingo. So I'll ask you to introduce the song and the name and tell us a little bit about it.
It's called Gwibara na Don, and it means Gwibara of the Waves. And when I was 14, I had a habit of listening to Simply Folk, and I came rushing in, and I threw on my tape recorder. I know that's illegal, but I was 14. I didn't know any better. And I just, you know, started recording, and this song came on. I'd never heard anything like it in my life, and it literally changed the course of my life. It's probably why I'm here, mm-hmm. actually, at public radio, because I was just so captivated by it.
Drandan san chan jeladan foi baran nagalcha gui baran dan.
Moya Brennan there. Now, about the beauty of autumn, but yeah, this inspired you, I think, to learn Gaelic.
To pursue music, to the idea of singing unaccompanied. It just rocked mm-hmm. my world. It's just so the opposite. I mean, I love rock songs. Don't get me wrong. I love them. But to hear just the human voice stripped down, it just rocked my world. That's actually Enya's sister. You may be in listener land. I'm sure you've heard of Enya, the singer. This is Moya Brennan, her sister, singing.
That sort of speaks to the power of music, too. That one song can, like, hit you probably, you know, just in the right moment. Maybe if you'd heard it a week or later or earlier, who knows?
Who knows? And then to find out, I was going to do this song anyway today, and then our wonderful producer reminded me that the songs were supposed to be about autumn, and I'm like, oh, and I'm like, wait, the whole song is about autumn. So I was glad to be able to sneak it in, but the words are just so amazing. And at the end, the poet says, I have one request at the end of my life, that my soul should reside among the brown leaves that grow on your shores, Guibara of the waves.
We're talking to Sheila Shigley, host of WPR's Simply Folk, talking about folk music written for and about the fall season, from serene, scenic, melancholy to spooky. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a favorite fall song, a favorite autumn-related folk song in particular that you love to hear, maybe to sing your own self, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation. Hear some more songs on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Sheila Shigley, host of WPR's Simply Folk, taking us through a fall seasonal soundtrack from Songs of the Harvest and Home and even some horror. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Becca is with us in Elk Mound. Becca, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I don't have any folk-specific songs, but I'm a teacher, and right now my students are really loving just pumpkin spice jazz music. We just search that online, and it comes up with awesome playlists that are all instrumental music. They really enjoy that. And also, I have three little girls, and so our season is filled with two songs, Ghostbusters theme song and Werewolves of London on repeat constantly.
Becca, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Well, that takes us into the scary part of our itinerary here, Sheila. What do you have for us? A Sheila K. Adams clip, I think.
We have Sheila K. Adams. So we've been spending some time in Ireland, and now we're going to bring it across the pond. And this is a song that started out in the old world and came over here. And we're going to hear Sheila K. Adams explain a little bit about that.
I think probably what happened when these ballads started to be passed down from generation to generation, that probably happened in the old country over in Scotland and England. And it was like historical recitation, if you know what I mean. Like an event would take place, and then they would write this big long song about it. And a lot of those songs that they sang over there came over here because that was a part of home.
Oh, holiday, oh, holy day, the first day of the year. Little Matthew Groves to church did go, some holy words to hear. Hear some holy words to hear. He spied some women dressed in black as they came into view. Lord Dan'l's wife was gaily clad, the flower of the few, the flower of the few. She stepped up to little Matthew Groves, her eyes cast on the ground. Said, please, oh, please come with me, stay as you pass through this town, town as you pass through this town. Oh, please come with me, stay, I'll hide thee out of sight. I'll pleasure you beyond compare and sleep with you all night, night I'll sleep with you all night.
I don't know, Sheila. The minor key makes me think this isn't going to end well.
It doesn't end well. Oh. It doesn't end well for everybody. But, you know, we're going to go on to another version of that in a minute. And this is such a great metaphor because traditional song is so much like planting and growing things. Like it grows and it flowers and then the seeds drop and then it becomes something new. And it just keeps changing as it goes from hand to hand and mouth to mouth.
She gave us Fairport Convention doing their version of Matty Groves. Here's a listen.
Her eyes about her.
So it seems like there's this wave of Fairport Convention and I think, what, Steel Eye Span and other kind of electrified, drummed up versions of older folk songs.
Yes, and of course, you know, at first it would shock people and then, of course, they got used to it and it just kept undulating and it got new life. I mean, that's the same song. This is the same song we just heard Sheila K. Adams sing, Separated by Generations and Thousands of Miles.
That is Maddie Groves by Fairport Convention talking to Sheila Shigley, our own Sheila Shigley from WPR's Simply Folk. Back to your calls now as we talk about great folk music for the fall season, spooky or otherwise. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Terry is with us now in Appleton. Terry, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Terry?
Well, I've got a lot of favorite songs. If you're talking about Fairport, of course, there, Tam Lynn is terrific. But a good Wisconsin fall song is The Fall Here by Clay Rynas, which came out about 20 years ago. Terrific Wisconsin singer-songwriter.
Terry, thanks for sharing that. I see you nodding, I think, Sheila.
I agree. We have Clay Rynas' albums in our library on our shelves. So grateful for that.
Terry, thanks a lot for that call. Can you talk a little bit about the folk scene here in Wisconsin? There's a lot of chances to see good folk music in the state, autumn or I guess other parts of the year, too.
It is thriving. I mean, we are hardy souls here in Wisconsin, so the outdoor concerts will probably still keep going for a good few more weeks. You can check things out at simplyfolk.org and find out. The folk calendar is up and running there, and it'll let you know what's still going on. And, of course, then we move to indoor concerts. So we have a very active folk scene from the top to the bottom of this state.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're not going to get to all the songs you shared with us. Let's stay spooky. Tell us about, how about Shankill Butchers by Sarah Jarosz?
Sarah Jarosz is one of my favorite. I call her a young singer. She's been around now for at least 10 years, and she has written an album full of just dynamite songs. This is from her debut album. It's from about 10 years ago. It's called The Shankill Butchers. It's a Halloween song.
Butchers ride tonight. You better shut your windows tight. They're sharpening their cleavers and their knives, and taking all their whiskey by the pint. 'Cause everybody knows.
Again, one that's not going to end well, I guess.
You know, as long as you stay inside, you'll stay away from those cleavers. But yeah, who doesn't love a good spooky song at this time of year? It's, you know, time to put on a fire, sit around and tell ghost stories, sing some of these numbers, maybe.
All right, well, let's get less scary now. Here's another seasonal one. This is a Neil Young song, Harvest Moon. Tell us about the cover version you have here.
The cover version features A.J. Lee, and she's singing here with her brother's Comatose. A.J. Lee is another one of those singers who's in high demand. She's very young, even younger than Sarah. I think she's barely 19 at this point, and she's singing here with the brother's Comatose.
A lot of room in folk music for good Neil Young covers, I imagine.
Yeah, and A.J. Lee, she might not even be 19. She's been singing since she was about 9 or 10.
Wow.
And she sings with Molly Tuttle. It used to be the Tuttles and A.J. Lee. And, of course, now they're all going on to win Grammys here and there. But great stuff. If you were at Sugar Maple Folk Festival this year, you may have seen A.J. Lee. She usually tours with her band Blue Summit.
All right, time for one more caller. Barbara is with us in Mundelein, Illinois. Do I have that right, Barbara?
Yes.
And what did you want to share with us?
Well, you mentioned Gaelic music. We're seeing Altan on Sunday there. I don't know if I can say her name.
I bet Sheila could fill in the gap for you. Altan, I think you're familiar with, Sheila.
Yep, Moyani Weenie.
And,
yes, they're going to be in Chicago on Sunday, and she sings beautiful, mystical, magical Gaelic songs.
Oh, talk a little bit about All Ten, Sheila.
I just think so highly of them. And, of course, they're neighbors of Moya Brennan. So you know, those sisters went on to found Clannad, and Enya went solo. And then just down the road were the Niweenies, the Omeenies, as we would say, and they were forming their band All Ten. So, yes, I highly agree with you. This is going to be a wonderful, wonderful show.
Barbara, thanks a lot for sharing that, and enjoy the show today. Oh, let's pick one more. Waterbound by Rhiannon Giddens and Francesco Teresi. Tell us about it before we play it.
Rhiannon is just, she's in so many wonderful, wonderful projects. You may know her with Our Native Daughters. You may know her with her work with Francesco Teresi. And I think at the end, autumn is just, I mean, all seasons are, but autumn especially is really just about coming together, missing home, and just enjoying the warmth of community.
All right, let's give a listen to Waterbound.
Chickens crowing in an old pine tree. Chickens crowing in an old pine tree. Chickens crowing in an old pine tree down in North Carolina.
Sheila, thanks so much for sharing all this great music with us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Sheila Shigley, host of WPR Simply Folk. She was with us to share some seasonal folk music and heighten our fall mood. We'll have to do this more often. Listen to Sheila and Simply Folk every Sunday from 5 to 8 p.m. on the Ideas Network, the News and Music Network. She even plays the whole songs. We don't really get to do that here. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Wisconsin photographer Pete Souza shares his time working in the White House and his new book called Beyond the Oval Office. We'll look at Russia, Ukraine, and U.S. policy as we head toward the midterms. And if you want to listen, want to visit a state park, start with a visit to the library. You can check out state park passes. That's today, tomorrow on Central Time from 3 until 6. Coming up after the news, the culinary historian who inspired the Netflix series High on the Hog is coming to UW-Stevens Point today and tomorrow. We'll talk to her about her work and trace the history of African influence on American dining. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the National Assessment of Educational Progress released a report that shows math and reading skills declined among middle and elementary school students since the start of the pandemic. We'll look at the results and what we can and can't learn from these assessment tests. First, African flavors and food traditions have had a big influence on American cooking. But our next guest says those contributions haven't always been widely understood or recognized. Her award-winning book, High on the Hog, was recently adapted as a Netflix series. It traces the global history of Africa's impact on American food from before the transatlantic slave trade through today. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you watched and or read High on the Hog? Where do you see Africa's impact on American food? What questions do you have about the history of these food traditions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jessica B. Harris is a leading culinary historian and expert on foodways of the African diaspora and the winner of a James Beard Lifetime Achievement Award. And she'll be talking at UW-Stevens Point in Wausau today at 6 and at UW-Stevens Point main campus tomorrow at 6. Both events free with pre-registration. Jessica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
What got you started down this path of tracing this incredible history of African and African-American cooking?
In a word, my mouth. But it's a little more complicated than that. It goes back probably to the 1970s at that point in time. I was the travel editor for Essence magazine, and then from Essence began to make connections, the different places that I visited, tasted things. It's like, oh, that tasted like something I had last week or 2 months ago or last year. And then I started drawing lines, not only mentally, but then research lines and looking at A, B, and seeing if they connected and maybe how they went on to connect with C. And the rest, as they say, is, if not history, at least the story of my life.
And as you started doing this, you kept finding more and more gaps in the actual history, and I think our current understanding of that history when it comes to Black Americans' contributions to the food we eat today? What were the gaps you were hoping to fill in this project?
Oh, goodness. It wasn't so much as gaps as it was probably what I would call silences. Mm-hmm. I think the thing is that in many cases, things were not so much eliminated as simply glossed over. I once gave a lecture called Studying the Silences that talks about how one of the things that I learned to do was how to reread my readings of history, how to look at things sort of obliquely, how to look at the things that weren't said as much as the things that were said, and maybe through those things that were eliminated, glossed over, or just, you know, casually not mentioned, begin to make and draw and look for my history.
And a big part of the premise for your book, and I agree with it, is that we can learn a lot about ourselves and our cultures through the food we eat, how we make it, who we eat it with. Can you talk about the value of this close examination of food in particular?
Well, I mean, we're humans, and the bottom line about food for humans, at least, is if we don't eat, we die. And so it is enormously important. We have to eat. And because we have some degree of choice about what we eat, we then form our cultures around what we eat, or what we eat expresses our cultures, which is probably a better way to say it. So that old adage, you are what you eat, is never more important. We are exactly what we eat, whether we are what we eat by what is actually on the plate, or we are what we eat by what is no longer on the plate, or what is refused on the plate. All of those things contribute to the who and the why of us.
A lot of the foods you trace, some of them we might associate today with Black American food or African American food. A lot of them, I think, we see as American food without realizing some of the connections. Can you talk about daily staples in the United States like macaroni and cheese and others that have this this silence in the history?
Well, I mean, I think people are fascinated by mac and cheese. I know one of the things that I have in my house that is something that people just go gaga over is many, many years ago, I did some consulting work for Kraft Foods. And as a thank you, they put my picture on a mac and cheese box. It was never sold in stores, but I have one copy and it's framed and in my kitchen, and people just go, oh, my goodness, you're on the mac and cheese box. I think the thing is that it really has a resonance for us. It means holidays, it means home, it means whatever the varying and various things are that it means to us, whether we are Black or white or chartreuse. But I think the thing that's often forgotten is it is a dish that was popularized by an African-American chef. His name was James Hemings. He was the enslaved chef of Thomas Jefferson. He was an extraordinarily talented person. He was so talented that when Jefferson was in Paris as the ambassadeur plénipotentiaire to the court of Louis the XVI, the late Louis the XVI, I might add, he sent for Hemings to join him in Paris. Hemings did. There's a whole long story about that, which we don't have time for. But the thing is that as a result, when Hemings is leaving France, and he does leave France to return to the United States, when he does that, he is bringing some recipes with him. And among those recipes is an essentially Italian dish that he has learned in Europe, which comes to the States and becomes our mac and cheese.
Jessica B. Harris is with us, author of the book High on the Hog, which was made into a Netflix series. Jessica, speaking in Wisconsin today and tomorrow, 6 p.m. today at UW Stevens Point in Wausau, tomorrow at 6 at the UW Stevens Point main campus. You could join in if you have a question for Jessica about the history we're talking about at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jessica, speaking of things we don't have time to do, you've eaten so many foods in so many places in Africa. What were some of the foods that you ate there that, as you mentioned, really struck a chord with you as similar to things you might have eaten here in the States?
Well, I think the main thing, well, the one that was my as Oprah would put it, aha moment, was in 1972. I was in Senegal doing research for my doctorate, and I was actually with my mother, and I had a dish called poulet yassa, or yassa ganar, and was chicken yassa. Now, it wasn't a familiar dish, but it combined a variety of tastes that were familiar, that were sort of home taste to me. It was chicken that had been grilled and then stewed. First marinated, then grilled, then stewed. So you get flavor infused in it three different ways. The chicken is marinated with onion and lemon juice, so you get that sort of citrusy thing. I happen to adore onions. The great apocryphal Jessica tale is that I used to sit on my mother's kitchen floor as a young child and eat them like apples. But so onions, lemons, chicken, it tasted unfamiliar and yet familiar. So that was the thing that sort of set off my light bulb. The other Senegalese dish, which does have descendants, if you will, in this country, would have been the national dish of Senegal, which is cheboujen. Cheb means rice. So this is a rice that is made red with tomato paste or tomato sauce and then served with vegetables and fish. Now, the dish as it wasn't something I was familiar with. But certainly the rice is something I was familiar with. The tomato paste. The tomato paste flavoring the rice was equally something I was familiar with. And that dish goes on to become what some of us know as jollof rice. Jollof because of the Wolof Empire the Jollof Empire of the Wolof people. It goes down into Ghana and Nigeria, and they fight about it, whose dish it really is. And then it comes across the Atlantic, and here we find its descendants in things like Louisiana's jambalaya and Charleston's red rice.
Now, both your book and the Netflix series take a close look at the intersection of food and slavery, the slave trade and the realities of slavery here in the United States. Can you share a little bit of that intersection with us?
I'm not really sure. The bottom line is, for more than 200, possibly longer years in this country, what would become the United States, African Americans have been at the bedrock of the agriculture and much of the culinary. Certainly in the southern parts of the United States, the agriculture, north, central, and south, it's kind of hard to grow the food, process the food, prepare the food, cook the food, and serve the food without having some degree of influence. So I'd say our influence is pretty strong.
We're talking to Jessica B. Harris, expert on foodways of the African diaspora, author of a lot of books, including High on the Hog, recently adapted as a Netflix series, speaking today in Wausau, tomorrow in Stevens Point. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the history of African food, African-American food here in the United States, the influence it's had? Are we talking about your family's own food traditions? Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with culinary historian Jessica B. Harris. I have two talks she's giving, one in Wausau today at 6, another in Stevens Point tomorrow at 6. We've got a link at WPR.org/Central Time for event info. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the history of African influences, African-American influences on American food. There are a lot of them. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller with Jeff in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I went to Chicago when I was a kid and went to Union Station, and my grandpa got me to try grits, and we tried chitlins, and I'd never tried those things before. But as a kid, I thought they were pretty cool. But my question is about shortening bread. Is there such a thing called shortening bread or shortening bread?
Yes, there is. In fact, you know the song probably. Mammy's little baby loves shortening. Mommy's little baby loves shortening bread. Put on the skillet, put on the lead. Mama's going to make some shortening bread. It is cornbread in some cases, sort of skillet cornbread. And for other people, it's almost like a tea cake. So you got a whole lot of leeway in between. But the shortening bread, I believe, is the sort of skillet cornbread.
Jeff, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We got an email from Grant who says, it seems African peanut stews are well known, but how have peanuts been used in other African dishes?
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting is that we kind of think of the peanut as being native to the African continent, and it's not. It is actually native to this hemisphere. It goes early to the African continent where it supplants something that's called the Bambara groundnut, which is another sort of rhizome, or not rhizome, anyhow, another plant that's similar to peanuts. What happens with that is it takes over some of those stews, some of those sauces, but they also turn up in marinades. They turn up just plainly on the street. I mean, one of my fondest memories of Senegal is they cook peanuts in heated sand, and the peanuts get really, really toasted and brown. They're called ngerte, and if you walk down any of the streets, you can buy a little cone of newspaper and have the ngerte, the peanuts, in them to eat.
Interesting. Thanks for emailing that question, Grant. Another silent part of the history I had no idea about, Jessica. Catering, pretty common line of work in the United States today. Can you talk about some of the early African-American pioneers of what we now call the catering business?
Okay, I can, but I'm doing that tonight.
Uh-oh.
At Wausau.
Well, give us a sneak preview. You don't have to spill the whole thing.
Tiny sneak preview is they used to say in Philadelphia, if you were a caterer, if you weren't a caterer, you were kind of in the soup. But if you were a caterer, you were living high on the hog. And that's a bad paraphrasing of a quote that I will have the exact version of tonight.
Excellent. Now, I know you're looking at the history, of course, but you have hopes for what people take away from it for the modern day and the way we, I think of food. What are you hoping that people take from your book or the Netflix series and do with it in the future?
Well, I think there are a lot of things. I think the most valuable, if you will, thing about food is when we share food, we learn that we're more alike than we are different. I mean, we've talked about peanuts, we've talked about various rice dishes, so many cultures across the board, African American and other, share these foods, these ingredients. And I think that when we start to look at what's in each other's pots, if you will, we can say, maybe not that different from me.
Talking to Jessica B. Harris, culinary historian, author of the book High on the Hog. There is a Netflix series of the same name, looking at the history of African food, African-American food, this huge influence on the United States. Go to WPR.org/Central Time. Because she's talking tonight in Wausau, tomorrow in Stevens Point. Are there foods, Jessica, when you're here in the United States, you look back to your trips to Africa and you think, I wish I was eating this there with them right now?
Oh, yes, many, many, many meals. One notable one that sort of sprang immediately to mind when you started kind of in on that question is, oh, gosh, multiple decades ago, let me just leave it at that, some friends, some newly made friends who have now been my friends for more than about 40 years, I met totally by accident. I was doing an interview and at the husband's office. He is an expansive man and said, oh, you must come home for dinner. I later found out that his wife had told him, if you bring another person home for dinner, I'm going to divorce you. So rather than have a divorce, she said, so we're going out. And they picked a place. It was called Chez Mbaye Mbarek. It is on the outskirts of Dakar on a beach. It is a place that specializes in meshoui. Meshoui is a spit-roasted lamb. And so I got to know these people for the first time, sitting in sort of beach chairs with a table in between us, picking delicate, tender pieces of lamb off of the lamb that had been spit roasted and forming a friendship. And that was my idea of pretty darn good meal.
That sounds really good. That idea of forming a friendship, I mean, there's something magical about having a meal with someone. That's almost like a dividing line between an acquaintance and a friend. Why is that?
Well, I think it's the commensality of food. It is the sharing spirit almost over food. It is the part about sharing a meal with someone that is almost the magic, that is the part that becomes spiritual. I have a hard time eating with people I don't like. You know, sometimes business lunches are a little difficult. I equally sometimes have a hard time with eating people I don't know. But I love to eat with people simply because I find that I learn so much about them through just sitting with them, through sharing with them. And that idea of sharing food among people, sharing food around a table, is important. I contend that, you know, a lot of peace treaties are signed around tables. A lot of stuff happens around tables, and I think there is something about the locus of table, whether or not it's a table in the European sense or a mat on the floor or any other variation of it. Gathering around it creates community, and that's the thing I like about sharing food.
And we've talked mostly about food today. You've written a lot about food, but you have studied and written about a lot of other things. I get the impression that you have just kind of, I don't know, an insatiable sense of curiosity. Why has curiosity been such an important value for you?
Because I'm a nosy broad, in a couple of words. I mean, I just want to know, you know. I just am curious about things. I have been fortunate to have had an extraordinary education, and it has allowed me to pursue some avenues. Why is this? How is this? What makes this happen? Who does that? Why are y'all doing that over here and not over here? All of those questions are things that I want the answer to, and so I just keep poking my nose in until I get the answer or I get smacked on the nose.
Now, for people out there listening who've gotten hungry, like I have, listening to you talk about these foods, and maybe who aren't familiar with a lot of the different foods you're writing about, can you suggest some good starting points, things that they could cook and maybe get, you know, maybe not perfect, but in the right neighborhood, maybe a little advice to try some of the foods that are part of this history?
Oh, goodness. I mean, I think that there are just so many recipes. There's so many African-American cookbooks, needless to say my own, but there are other writers. I mean, Toni Tipton Martin has written a book called Jubilee. Carla Hall has several books out. Blanking on names now. There are also histories. Adrian Miller has a history of black barbecue called Black Smoke. Library, or as a rude friend of mine says, Google you. Or, you know, do a little research, cursory research. It doesn't have to be a deep dive, but you'll find names. Go to the library. Librarians are your friend. Librarians are wonderful. They will help you. They will find recipes for you. Because recipes are so personal. Some people like the savory. Some people like the sweet. For me to recommend something would be, you know, crazy. I've talked about the chicken yassa. It was a good starting point for me. It might be for other people. I do a column, if I can advertise my own column.
You can.
For eatingwell.com called Diaspora Dining. I do another one for the Today Show, today.com, that is called My Culinary Compass. And for those who are still reading magazines like me, I do a third one for Southern Living that's about Southern food. They've all got recipes, too.
Jessica, thanks so much for joining us, and enjoy your time in Wisconsin.
Thank you so very much. I'm enjoying being here. I even brought a coat, so I'm good for the weather.
Excellent. That's Jessica B. Harris, culinary historian, leading authority on food traditions of the African diaspora, and author of a lot of books, including High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America. It's recently turned into a Netflix series of the same name. You can hear more. She's talking to UW Stevens Point's Wausau campus today at 6. Also at UW Stevens Point's main campus tomorrow at 6. Both events are free with pre-registration. We've got a link to event info at WPR.org/Central Time. She mentioned the author, Toni Tipton Martin. Check out our archives. We talked to her about that book, Jubilee. Coming up after the news, a national exam shows students' math and reading abilities have slipped since the start of the pandemic. An expert joins us for a look at the results and what they mean, what it'll take to recover. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.